There was a time when Alaska had the loosest approach to marijuana in the nation. That was then. Now, two states have outright legalized, and it's under consideration on others, including here. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Time to check in with former Alaskan Doug Fine, who predicted this after documenting the sheer massiveness of the industry in California. Our number, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Do we have a cultivation potential here? An industry? That's the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
They called it the war on drugs. Now Doug Fine is talking about, what is it?
The drug peace era.
The drug peace era. Doug Fine, welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Good to have you back on.
Great to be with you, Steve.
We're speaking to Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. And he's on location at his ranch in New Mexico, where he raises the few goats he has remaining after a grizzly bear raid. How many goats are you up to, Doug?
We're rebuilding our herd. A neighbor very kindly sold back one of our nannies that we had sold to her last year. So we're still not having to go to the store for protein, at least.
Okay, great. And are you still finding enough biofuel to burn?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A neighbor of mine actually has taken it upon himself to filter all the southern New Mexico's unhealthy restaurants' grease traps and sold it to me for $2 a gallon, which is, in the non-Alaskan world, still about half the pump price of diesel.
Same here. So, yes, we had you on, I think, the first time to talk about your Farewell My Subaru book, which was about converting over to biofuels and driving around the country and smelling like a cheap restaurant from time to time.
And, giving myself and everyone else the munchies in the process, yeah.
It was a funny book and an enjoyable conversation in our continuing quest to talk about energy and sustainability and things like that. And then not too long ago, we did a show on victimless crimes, and who should pop up but Doug Fine again with his book Too High to Fail, in which you had gone up to Humboldt County and seen an enormous industry, which had kind of been an underground industry, and now it seemed to be a growing industry, of absolutely colossal dimensions. Maybe you could just thumbnail that just a little bit for me. I guess it's now to the point where the medical marijuana dispensers and so forth in California they have brands, and they're prescribed for different ones for different ailments and all this sort of thing.
Right. This may be just as true amongst certain farmers in, say, the Matanuska Valley in Alaska, but in the Emerald Triangle, the famous cannabis cultivation region in Northern California, that actually comprises like 5 or 6 counties, but the triangle is considered to be Humboldt, Mendocino, and Trinity counties near the Oregon border. They're into their third generation where cannabis is 80% of the economy. It is the economy. And what happened in Mendocino County was the sheriff, who was a local boy, twice elected Republican, recognized the billions that were being generated, with a B, locally, right about the same time that the local county government told him he had to fire 18% of his force due to budget cutbacks. So he came up with this novel approach of what he described as recognizing the T-Rex in the room. And long story short, it was a job-creating, revenue-generating crime-reducing and, in fact, sustainably-minded. There were sustainability guidelines written into this ordinance, which was known as the zip-tie ordinance, because the way it worked was farmers could buy up to 99 bright yellow zip ties like you might use to repair your truck. And for all of that, for payment to the county, third-party inspectors, zoning requirements, it cost the farmer about $8,500 for a crop that grossed. It was pretty low prices right about then, so I'll be very, very conservative and say $250,000 for a farm of 99 plants. It was an unmitigated success. 100 farmers were brave enough to come above ground and talk about, you know, what they do. They're American farmers contributing to America's number one crop. And it raised, so Sheriff Allman, the name of the sheriff in Mendocino, was laughed out of the room when he proposed this. No one believed that he was going to raise the $500,000 he needed to save the deputy jobs. And he actually raised $600,000. It was to be recreated all over the Emerald Triangle, and then it would have expanded, I think, nationwide or internationally. It was a program designed to benefit local farmers. There was no way that big corporations could take it over. The county was in charge of it, et cetera, et cetera. But, spoiler alert, for those who haven't read Too High to Fail, the feds decided that more important than, say, 50,000 homicides in Mexico over the last couple of years, more important than that was devoting your taxpayer dollars to coming in at machine gun point and shutting down the zip tie program and threatening the local government with federal drug conspiracy charges for reducing local crime and raising revenue in a sustainable manner.
Wow.
That was more than a thumbnail, Steve, but that's what happened in Mendocino.
What a story. Well, okay, now the reason that I called you last week was because it looks like Attorney General Eric Holder has seen the same T-Rex in the room.
That's right. I mean, the drug war is over. The analogy to the Vietnam era was like the years between 1973 and 1975, where there wasn't any talk about beating North Vietnam or the Viet Cong. It was, when the hell are we going to get out of there and how? And that's the side of the warriors, the drug warriors, in America's longest and most expensive war. 40-plus years and $1 trillion taxpayer dollars spent thus far and counting. And that money is still being spent. The Attorney General basically announced that the executive branch would like to see some stuff happen, basically, is the reading between the lines. I can get into the specifics of what he actually said. But only thing that matters is that the Controlled Substances Act, federal law, currently classifies cannabis, one of humanity's longest used plants, which study after study indicates is less dangerous than alcohol. Let's not discount any downsides. It's not to say that cannabis is legal and all of a sudden, war, strife, and hunger end. I'm just saying every study shows it's less dangerous than alcohol, which we've agreed should be legal. The Controlled Substances Act, by contrast, says cannabis is more dangerous than meth and cocaine and has absolutely zero medical value, if you're talking about the medical side of it. That's what federal law says. That's been federal law for 40 years. In fact, the drug czar, the head of the President's Office of National Drug Control Policy, is not allowed by law to speak against the Controlled Substances Act. He doesn't have his constitutionally guaranteed free speech rights. Because if you do speak about it, you're either saying it doesn't work and let's end it, or you lie. So what they do is they lie to keep the $9 billion that we spend fruitlessly going into this war, going after the wrong targets, et cetera, going. So there's no talk of winning the drug war. It's just about a bureaucracy, multi-billion-dollar bureaucracy that, it's time to end for the good of America.
But Holder didn't quite go that far. All he really said was, here are our enforcement guidelines, and they don't include going to court to strike down these state laws in Washington and Colorado.
Yeah, so the first part of the statement was, we don't intend to pursue federal legal action in states which have legalized cannabis.
Right.
There were all these other conditions that went along with it that were embedded, and some people have a lot of problems with. I should mention that the Attorney General's office has made similar promises in the past, promised not to interfere with state medical programs a few years ago. That led to what people called the Green Rush, and that's what I was covering in Too High to Fail. And then they just decided, no, sorry about that. We didn't actually mean to allow capitalism to work and a multi-billion-dollar industry to start. We're going to actually start raiding again. So that could always happen. All that needs to happen for the perspective of my journalistic view of, for the good of the country, is the Controlled Substances Act removes cannabis so that states can regulate it something like they do alcohol.
Well, so you talk about the drug piece. Would there be a peace dividend? Can you hypothesize about that, Doug Fine?
Without question. Let's just look at Mendocino County, because there's all kinds of, a national pundit in a suit in a city using the internet would call up everyone's economist predictions. I'll tell you really what's going on the ground in one county in California where I lived and worked for a year, followed a plan for 10 months from farm to patient, liver cancer patient. And so in Mendocino County in 2010, law enforcement seized 600,000 cannabis plants. And they claim that that's 10% of the crop. The locals laugh. It's not even 1% of the crop, but let's be generous and say it's 10% roughly, giving us about 6 million plants that made it to market just in this one county in California in 2010. So 6 million plants. Outdoor cultivated plants, again, as I bet quite a number of farmers in the Mountain Nooska Valley and other places in Alaska can attest, outdoor cultivated cannabis can have up to 10 pounds of flowers, which are the marketable, product from a cannabis plant. 10 pounds of flowers per plant. I'm going to call it 1 pound per plant. So we're talking about 6 million plants, 1 pound. The lowest that ever wholesale farm prices ever reached, if they're absolute nader for a short time, was $1,500 a pound. So I'm going to go even lower and say they only got $1,000 per pound. Long-winded way of saying $6 billion just to farmers in Mendocino County. It's probably way higher than that, and that's just 1 year. So if those people are on the books and paying taxes, it's a multi-billion dollar impact to the economy from one poor county in California. And this is America's nation one crop nationwide.
Okay. And then also, I think if there is a peace dividend, you have to look at incarceration rates and things like that. You know, I looked into our corrections budget in Alaska is around $300 million a year. It's about 6% drug offenders. But we have a two-thirds recidivism rate. In other words, people once they get in there, they're just plain outlaws, whatever their offense is. And I don't know what legalizing marijuana might remove from that equation, but I suspect it'd be more than that 6%. But I'm just guessing.
800,000 cannabis arrests in the U.S. last year, and several years after the same drug czar said we're not arresting people for using cannabis anymore. 800,000 people were arrested on all levels of law enforcement nationwide last year. So you're absolutely right. And there's several other peace dividends other than just the purely bottom line financial. And I'm glad that you brought that up so that, we aren't just talking numbers. Here's one that might on the surface sound ephemeral, but from reporting and traveling in Colorado and Washington to two states where adult social use of cannabis is legal today in Colorado by constitutional amendment. There is a palpable, and this is people describing their lives to me, a palpable diminishment in paranoia and social stigma. The stigma front is really the last front. Doesn't matter. You might have someone agreeing that cannabis is on paper safer than alcohol. He or she might still carry some sort of situation where if it were a PTA meeting and the meeting was over and people went on the deck and had a glass of wine, that glass of wine would be okay. If someone were to pull out a vaporizer or some sort of cannabis implement, that would probably be their last day on the PTA. So the stigma front is another peace dividend. And another important one is seniors and returning injured veterans from harm's way after serving our country are discovering that cannabis is providing physical pain relief for things like arthritis, cancer pain, all that kind of stuff, cancer treatment, but also for helping people get off psychotropic pharmaceuticals for things like PTSD. and issues to do with the brain and psychological and emotional stuff.
Well, and let's not forget, just plain inflammation. And also, I've heard that chemo. I've got a friend that's on chemo that finally got on the medical marijuana, and it's like, oh, he can eat. You know, this is another benefit. Well, okay, we're speaking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, and this is going to get probably to your next book here, this next call, Doug. If you're ready,
I'm ready.
We'll hear from the agricultural area of Delta Junction. And Shelley joins the program. Shelley, you're on the air on Talk of Alaska with Doug Fine.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I've long of growing hemp with all that fallow farmland that from the failed barley project of Delta Junction. And earlier, I think it was mentioned on the radio, does Alaska have a future, agricultural future, not only the growing of cannabis, but if it were legalized and accepted, then people would be over the paranoia about it, and we would be able to grow hemp again in this country. And not again, I say, because of course many people know that our founding fathers grew hemp in America.
Yeah, well, so, I you just threw a real softball to Doug, so let's let him take hold of it here.
I appreciate that, Shelley, because not just because I get to hype my next book, but because I get to talk about sustainability and outdoor cultivation of all varieties of the cannabis plant versus indoor cultivation. But first, to directly answer the question, yeah, at those latitudes today, Canadian farmers are making $300 profit per acre. So that compares to about $30 for wheat. And this is what I'm talking about, the industrial version of the plant. For people not familiar with the cannabis plant, it's all the same species. We switch over to the name hemp when there is, the generally accepted rule is there's less than 0.3% THC, which is one of 99 cannabinoids or chemical components of the cannabis plant and one that's known to be psychoactive. So, in other words, Woodstock happened because of THC. So, as long as it's 0.3% or lower in Canada, it doesn't matter what variety of the plant it is. It's legal to cultivate for industrial purposes. And today, the North American market is profitable because of hemp seed oil. So what you do if you wanted to cultivate in Alaska is grow certain varieties. One's called Finola. There's a bunch of others. The Canadian government's very generous with their information online. You can go to provincial agricultural websites and find out varieties and all that jazz. You know, you're breaking federal law to import it for now, to import live seed. But I just came back from a farm in Colorado. 60 acres are going strong. U.S. grown hemp used to be the best in the world. The other markets, the fiber markets, are not mature in North America yet. In other words, most hemp clothing comes from China, and most hemp paper and all that good stuff comes from Europe today. But that's not to say you couldn't start that industry in Delta Junction. So that would require different cultivars of varieties than the Finola and the oil varieties I was talking about. You'd want the huge 15-foot kind of stock, which, again, mapping the Matanuska Valley psychoactive cannabis market, which was the first story I ever covered in Alaska. I can't remember what year it was, but it was a story that wound up running in High Times magazine, but was assigned originally by the San Francisco Bay Guardian about Alaska cannabis industry.
Yeah, was that this century or the one before, Doug?
That was last century.
Yeah, what I was thinking.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that with the summers, we could maybe even have an end product, a paper plant to, stimulate some economic activity, in that direction. But people won't even talk about it until cannabis is not just decriminalized but legal. So I would like to see that happen for many reasons.
Hemp might be legalized this year, by the way. The industrial side of cannabis has already passed the House, and it's in the Farm Bill.
Yeah, that'd
be great.
So
we may see that this year.
Okay.
And to finish the thought there, I'll give you a teaser on my hemp book that's coming out in March on hemp paper, as well as an ebook. And we're still deciding between a couple of titles. But it's a book about hemp. And the one big piece of advice that one of the moguls, the early Canadian hemp moguls up there, told me, because their industry is 15 years old now, is the value of your hemp increases tenfold or more the minute you put it in a bottle and call it something. So, yeah, you could, as soon as you, he was talking about hemp seed oil, but if you were doing fiber and, you know, tree-free Alaskan paper, are you kidding me? Yeah, you'd have a great marketing angle there and would be creating local jobs. Last point, if I could, real quick, Steve, is on the sustainability front, cannabis is already America's number one cash crop, and that's without the hemp variety even being part of it. And I think the hemp variety is going to wind up being bigger than the psychoactive side, just the way that we might say Coors and Budweiser are big, but Exxon is bigger. Hemp has real potential as an energy source as well. So the entire cannabis plant is far and away our country's number one crop already. And when it comes above ground, it must be implemented into our economy sustainably. And that generally means, switching back to the psychoactive side for a minute, cultivated outdoors rather than indoors. And people think, oh, how could you do that in Alaska? Alaska has had one of the longest branded names in cannabis in the world, and I don't think I can say it on the air.
No, actually, you can't.
Look it up. It's Matanuska Thunder Something. And
Thunder Something, so, I like that. Yeah.
So you can cultivate outdoors in Alaska, and if you market that, it can be just as valuable as cultivating indoors, which requires a lot of energy use and often a lot of application of unnecessary pesticides.
Shelley?
Well, yeah, and the inside thing, too. In Fairbanks, we've got these a few huge box stores been vacant for, I don't know, how many years, and they are, as far as the energy goes, I understand that people are continually working on lights that take a lot less energy. So I'll just get off. I appreciate your work, and I will get off the phone and let somebody else have a chance for a change.
All right, Shelley. Thanks a lot for calling in from from your piece of country there, a very interesting piece of geography. 1-800-478-8255, the phone number, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Wow, no email so far. That's something. But a great bubble screensaver has shown up on my call prompter, which I really like. And I wanted to, we're dealing with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, and a forthcoming book that they don't have a title for yet on the hemp industry, and he's been researching that and going out to hemp farms in Canada and also now the United States. Legal farms we're talking about here. And he's with us by phone. He has been with us for a few prior programs, and it's always fun to have Doug on. He's always up to something. And a very enterprising journalist, a very hard worker, and it's a pleasure to have you back on, Doug. And you talked about the Green Rush and diminishment of stigma, which I think is something I want to go to a little bit later on. I want to give out the phone number again, 800-478-8255. And then I want to take up this technology you talked about, vaporizer. What is that?
Oh, so there are a lot of different ways to carboxylize the cannabinoids in the cannabis plant, which is to say, to get high. And there are actually ways to use cannabis where you don't get high, all varieties of cannabis. In other words, eating it raw is kind of a big thing as a health maintenance deal in California, Northern California right now. You need an awful lot of flowers to throw it in your blender every day. So the joint might be on its way out. One thing that seniors are finding is helpful to them, and I've come across a lot of seniors who are coming to cannabis for a lot of things because they want to cut out pharmaceuticals in their medicine cabinet, which are zonking them out and killing them, which is not to say all pharmaceuticals are bad. We're really lucky to have a Western medicine industry, but boy, people are really on a lot, and any that they can get off is probably good for them because of things like side effects and toxic chemicals in them and whatnot. So seniors are finding that they don't want to be putting smoke into their lungs. So a way that they're able to use cannabis is through edibles. As long as the plant's been heated up, it will have an effect. So everything from lozenges to various kinds of food and breads and stuff like that. The vaporizer is kind of interesting. It's I think it's pretty similar to what people are calling e-cigarettes. You hear that discussed a lot these days. I don't know if they're exactly the same, but what a vaporizer does is it heats the plant up high enough to carboxylize. So in other words, it has the same effect as smoking, but it doesn't actually burn the plant material, so you're not getting smoke into the lungs. And a lot of people swear by it, Willie Nelson among them.
Willie! What do you know? Okay, let's go to... Yeah, I know.
80 years old, daily cannabis smoker, 157 shows this year. I'm just saying.
Yep. Let's go to Soldotna. And Bob joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Doug Fine, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen. And good morning to my old friends in Delta. I have some old friends that moved from the Badger Road area out there. Hello to you folks. And I'm all about states' rights and the Alaska brand, Alaskan grown concept. You know, several months ago when Colorado and Washington went legal with marijuana, there were some gentlemen on one of the national news programs. These guys had business degrees. They were clean-cut looking individuals and had business degrees in college. And they were working on a marketing plan for the state of Washington. And these gentlemen figured that within 4 years, they'd make $1 billion. And they would average out in about 10 years at $20 billion a year. You know, why doesn't the state of Alaska get on with that? You know, it can grow it commercially up here, sell it to these states that are legal, and we wouldn't have to be dependent on the big oil companies for revenue for our state anymore, or at least not as dependent. You know, I kind of feel like they kind of got us under a thumb the way things are, and this would be a value-added industry that would benefit the state, provide jobs, and I think it would be a good thing. I really do.
You know, it's amazing. I used to, when this program first started out, I was a phone screener, usually not hosting, and there was a woman in Homer that would call the show every week, and whatever the subject was, once she got on with the guest, she would turn the conversation around to, wouldn't it be great if we had a hemp industry in Alaska? And I used to.
Didn't Mr. Raven live down in Homer? Right?
I think. Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Was the Raven Amendment, which most of us know, was our right to privacy in the state of Alaska, and I believe was part of back in the 70s when Alaska decriminalized marijuana, and you could have up to, I think it was a pound, as long as it wasn't bagged up,
right,
and it was your property, and. You know, you could have a pound of dried weight, and, you know, everybody was good. But then so many people came up here and took advantage of that and were selling it and stuff to people. And then with the conservative movement, we have what we have now.
Yeah, we had a ballot measure. We've actually had two that I know of, maybe even three. But the one that counted was the one that made marijuana illegal, but also ran up against the Constitution, as it turned out. So the result is we have a sort of an unenforceable situation where simply personal use isn't, you know, they wouldn't want to enforce it because they'd run up against the Constitution, and the Attorney General doesn't want to do that. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your call from Soldotna. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We're rambling through the implications of legal marijuana and hemp with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail today. And, I don't know. I'm trying to think, with the stigma removed, Doug, I'm wondering what I would tell my grandchildren. I'm really wondering. You're a family man. But it's like... I don't somehow just say, well, it makes you kind of dumb, you know. It's not 100% great, kids. I just don't – I'm wondering about that, Doug.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Steve, because I know from – you know, I still feel that Alaska is my peeps, and, you know, I'm still very much an Alaskan at heart and been in Alaska for years. And so – and rural Alaska at that. And so I understand the dynamics that we're talking about. When I was an APRN station news director, I knew full well what could and could not be discussed in public vis-a-vis the plant. Now, those views are changing everywhere, and I bet that even in more remote, let's say more conservative parts of the state, that probably the libertarian view is taking shape as the lies of the drug war become more exposed. But that said, how we view somebody who has a beer versus somebody that for whom alcohol is not the drug of choice, and you know, the social lubricant of choice, and that they choose to in some way use cannabis instead of getting drunk. I'll tell you this as a father: if those are the choices, I'd say, and so would any cop, give me the cannabis person any day of the week. But yet that's still not where our minds are going. So I'm not trying to really change anybody's minds, because I don't really care. People can believe whatever they want. The historical facts are that there is no basis at all to the war on cannabis. I won't get into some of the other stuff, powdered synthetic cocaine and all heroin and all that stuff, but that I do think is terrible, and I don't cover in Too High to Fail. I only cover this plant, which happens to have been used by humans for 10,000 years and is in the oldest surviving human medical handbook from China. But on top of that, in the 30s, a lot of listeners will know this, but the historical sort of cliff notes are that Harry Anslinger ran alcohol prohibition, which imploded overnight, as cannabis prohibition is imploding right now as we speak. And so his next job was first head of the Bureau of Narcotics, and he actively searched around for, you know, how am I going to have a budget and money and offices and power and people under my command if there's no enemy? And they found a convenient, often racially tinged scapegoat in this plant. He got the idea from my region, the Southwest here, where Anglo and Latino power structures were in close, close competition for control of the region, especially in Arizona. And so one of the Anglo scare tactics to rally the vote was, these Mexicans are smoking this loco weed and dating your blonde women. And so Harry Anslinger changed that to black jazz singers would give quotes to Congress along these lines, to the New York Times. And so we launched what we're now in the 77th year of, oh my gosh, somebody uses cannabis, write them off. They can't be a teacher, a preacher, a politician. Oh, my gosh, no way. But, boy, they got bombed at the Christmas party last year. That's fine. Puking all over, driving home and crashing into people, increase in violence, alcohol, that's fine. I can't explain it. The stigma's there. I was raised with the stigma, and it's my professional opinion that it needs to go away.
Thanks a lot, Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Doug Fine is calling it the drug peace and talking about a peace dividend. The title of the show is Implications of Legal Marijuana and Hemp, and Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, is with us. A few years ago that he wrote that book, and he's moved on to a book about the hemp industry now and what it might become. And I want to get back to the possible Alaska implications here, Doug, and one of them seems to be this business you were talking about outdoor growing leading to a better product? I mean, I guess in terms of the amount of flowers and all that.
Not just the amount of flowers, but for the type of person who is a consumer, and let's get the numbers straight here. 100 million Americans have used cannabis in their lives, including the last three presidents. For the type of consumer, when the war on cannabis ends, as it will here very soon, who would go to the farmer's market or cultivate their own tomatoes, or at least go to some sort of some sort of supermarket where organic or local options are available. Outdoor cultivated cannabis is far and away superior for the simple reason that why would you? Let's talk about another great Alaskan Manuscavelli crop, the cabbage, the famous big cabbages. Why would you buy a hothouse cabbage that God's sun hasn't smiled on when you could have a Manuscavelli bursting summer cabbage? Some of the great things about the solar daylight here. It's harder. It takes longer. It's far and away superior. So in terms of creating that market, Alaska has a real head start because of the AK-grown brand and the general reputation of the state, the state's brand as being a healthy outdoor place, the healthy last frontier, right? So I recall vividly, I was volunteering at a food bank when I lived in Mendocino County, and one of the guys was there on probation, was a busted local farmer who said that the reason why he doesn't support legalization, someone who's been in it for a couple of generations, is that it's only going to be like Coors and Budweiser are going to have joints in the corner store, and there's going to be no room for the small farmer. Well, actually, the truth of that is that transitions in economies, in this case from a prohibitionary economy to an above-ground economy, are jolting. I mean, it's any change is jolting. That's absolutely true. And most businesses fail, period. In this, most in capitalism, some huge majority of businesses fail. So all of that put together, yeah, it's a pretty risky environment. But if somebody decides that this is their calling and they are going to market a Matanuska family-based farm product with a brand name and mark it up like people mark up their sockeye salmon from the Copper River, they're going to be just fine. So it's really all about being good at what you do on the farming end and being good at marketing it.
Yeah, like Prohibition wiped out, it never quite wiped out the moonshiners, of course, but it wiped out a great many regional ethnic breweries and recipes and so forth like that. A few came back and a few survived, and now they're your boutique, and now we have a proliferation again. But, there's some truth to that there was a blending out. I mean, there were the big booze and liquor empires took over. When Prohibition was repealed pretty quickly, and it did become kind of an industrialized thing. We're speaking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And if you're in Anchorage, it's a local call of 550-8422. We're including hemp into this discussion here, and let's go out to Bethel. And Willie joins the program. Willie, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Doug Fine.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Nice overcast day here. Anyway, 16 years ago, I got busted for felony possession of marijuana. Yeah, and it's really malfunctioned my life because there was no SIS that went along with it. So it's all the jobs that you can't get. But I guided big game hunts for 16, 17 years, and one year I was guiding the nephew from the Shah of Iran, and we were doing sheep hunts, and we were sitting in camp one day on the strip, been up one valley, fixing to go up another, so we're eating lunch, and in comes a state trooper, fish and game guy, and he's retired now, but anyway, we're sitting there talking, and the client I had asked him, he says, well, how's the booze problem in these villages? And he just kind of throws his hands in the air, and he goes, holy cow. He says, it's a nightmare when a case of whiskey hits a village. And he says, if there was a way that I was guaranteed that there'd be no booze in the village, I'd fill that Super Cub with all the marijuana I could and give it away free, because it's better to have an anesthetized crowd than a drunk crowd. Now, having been a dope smoker, for me, it affects me to where I believe marijuana breeds laziness and irresponsibility, and I understand it affects everybody differently. But that's kind of the message I try to pass on to my kids.
Very good. I'm glad you. This is a big question that I really wanted asked, and I really appreciate your thoughts on that, because the best I could come up with is makes you stupid. I like yours a little better.
Well, yeah, you know, but in all fairness, I signed the petition to go vote for marijuana because I do understand the amount of money that's changing hands, and there's no social benefit to it as far as taxes, or all it does is make people paranoid and have to do things backhanded. So I do support legalizing marijuana because it's a person's personal choice, and there's nothing you're going to do about it. They're going to do it, or they're not going to do it, you know? Well, and so that's kind of where I stand on it.
And but as a, you know, if you hadn't been, do you think you would have, I mean, you got out, you weren't one of these people that got incarcerated and found yourself, couldn't get out of the correctional system. You got out of it. But I'm wondering if, you know, how many people might have, you know, got started, got thrown into the correctional system at some point because of some kind of substance thing and basically just never could get out.
Well, I know lots of them like yeah. that.
Because it's really, yeah. there's a lot of strikes against you when you do get out, as you've just explained. And, you know, it's just, it always sits there. Well, I could kind of go, you know, I know the rules. I know how to navigate in this other world, this criminal world. And to get it out of the criminal region, just that's an interesting thought to me.
Well, to me, it doesn't make sense. I mean, if you live in Bethel, you hear on the radio the... It's what they call the state want team. It's a combination of troopers and city police or village police. And, oh, boy, we got somebody for an ounce of marijuana. It makes big news out here. Well, I go, ounce ain't for sale. An ounce is for personal consumption, you know. Yet they make a big deal out of it, and that's their job. You know, I'm not knocking the troopers or anybody else for that. You know, that's what we pay them for, and that's what we expect them to go do. But to me, it just don't make sense when the courts are so overloaded with things that are a lot, lot worse to be tying somebody up and popping them, dragging them all the way back from a village 200 miles back to Bethel, incarcerating them, turning them loose on personal, what you call the word there?
Cognizance. Recognizance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know? The next day, and then have to fly them back again. How much money does that cost? It costs $600 to go out to the coast round trip to Shivak, Hooper Bay. You know, that's just from Bethel. It costs more to travel in the villages than it does to take a trip from here. When you buy it online, you can go from here on Alaska Airlines to Mexico cheaper than you can go out to the villages most of the time.
I hear you. Thanks, Willie. Thanks for your call from Bethel.
All right. Keep up the good work, guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Pretty nice testimonial there.
Can I apply to one couple of things that Willie said?
Yeah.
There? Great. Okay, so thank you. First of all, that was really wonderful to hear his perspective, and I'm so sorry for his needless legal travails. It's insane. It's insane. There are people in jail for a long time for using a plant that doesn't hurt anybody. So anybody that happens to, anybody who's had legal problems knows that it can really mess up somebody's financial life. As you mentioned, and he had trouble getting jobs and all that. So I've heard so many stories like that, and I just wanted to acknowledge that that is no joke at all. As for the effects, what any, let's say, Chinese medical practitioner and herbalist will tell you, and we all, I think, will acknowledge that Chinese medicine has been around as long and is pretty much as effective as Western medicine. There, it's a different tradition, but a very successful one. The word for cannabis in Chinese medicine is ma. It's routinely administered during labor to help mothers give birth. There's a lot of reasons for that. We actually have what are known as cannabinoids in mother's milk. This is regardless of whether the mother uses cannabis. It's an ancient herb that people have used. And what any practitioner will tell you is that not every herb is meant to be used by every person. Certain herbs are contraindicated for certain people, and certain herbs are good for certain people. And so not everybody should use cannabis
But I think that one thing we know about the effects is that almost nobody becomes violent. Literally nobody has ever overdosed. So, you know, we don't want to downplay the negative side. You guys were kind of talking about maybe some people that get, I don't know, zonked out or stupid or something like that. More serious than that would be people that become dependent on this or anything. And that's important and that's possible. Studies show, gosh, I wish I could remember the exact percentage, but it's a considerably more percentage of people that use cannabis socially become dependent on it psychologically than do people that use just about anything else, and way lower than alcohol. So there are going to be some public health effects of ending the war on cannabis, but the cost benefit analysis is hugely skewed towards benefit when it comes to the benefits to America. And I'm just talking about public safety here. Forget about libertarian economic kind of ideals. I'm talking about the roads will be safer and people will actually be healthier, especially if they substitute cannabis in responsible social situations for alcohol. And the last thing I wanted to say about this is, regardless of whether or not one thinks that the cannabis plan is a beneficial thing, the bottom line is 40 years, America's longest war, 10 times longer than it took to squash the Nazis and Imperial Japan. If it's shown as anything, it's that prohibition doesn't work. It doesn't work. Cannabis has never been more available to young people, for instance, which I care about as a father. And that's because criminals don't ask for ID. Every study of places that have either legalized completely, such as Portugal, or implemented medical programs, such as New England, show decreases in underage use, something to do with the forbidden fruit phenomenon.
That's amazing.
So,
yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks. It's Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Talk of Alaska, we're talking about implications of legal marijuana and hemp. Once you get over the is it good, is it bad, and all that kind of stuff, then you get in, well, what if? And the what ifs are absolutely fascinating, and one person that can really help guide us down the what if path is somebody that has been investigating it for, what, the last 8 or 9 years? Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, in a forthcoming book that is as yet untitled about hemp growing. But Doug, Homer is finally chiming in, so let's go down to Homer.
All right.
Talk with Charlie. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Charlie.
Thank you. Good morning, all.
Morning.
I think what you tell your kids ought to be the truth, because you know they're going to find out on their own anyway. But what I'm kind of concerned about, I've been involved in this war for 40 years, and now that we see we're going to make some progress here, maybe they're complicating the matter. Well, for instance, you know, if the government's going to sponsor something, they're going to have to more or less guarantee the quality and the quantity. And so who's going to establish the standards about what's quality, what products you can use in growing it? You know, there's all kinds of different ways of growing it, and all kinds of different chemicals of one type or another, organic and inorganic, that you can use to enhance the product.
I'm imagining if this to regulate marijuana initiative were to pass in Alaska, I'm suddenly thinking of what Anna Faircloth and Mia Costello would make of it when it got into the legislature. They would have a field day picking it apart and finding, oh boy, regulation. I can see it all now.
Well, right. And then the other big thing is if we turn the Alaska into a hemp producing society, that's going to eliminate the medicinal quality product that could be grown, because the hemp will pollinate the medicinal amount. And I happen to be fighting lymphoma cancer right now and having being on both the pharmaceutical THC Delta 9, the synthetic, and also the stuff I get on the black market, which works way better than the medicinal product as far as...
Marinol, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd appreciate what you're doing, Doug, and if you got any comments on how this is complicating things. And, you know, I belong to a church, a THC ministry, and in Hawaii, our minister's been in the federal pen without trial and without bond for distributing medical marijuana to, of course, he didn't have a license to do so, but still, you know, it's selling marijuana. 3 years in prison without trial and without bond. That's Eric Holder. So thanks for a good program. I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Charlie.
Wow. I do have a couple comments, Steve, if I may, if we got time.
Yep.
So, first of all, obviously sending good health wishes to Charlie. I appreciate his call. And I'm glad that cannabis is working for him, as it does for many people, many different kinds of cancers. Not all cancers. You should do your research, speak to your doctor, ask around. It's a wide web out there on the internet. Do your research. A couple of points. You guys were talking about the field day that legislators could have and all the different barriers and stuff that could go in. But it's true, but there is precedent if it's treated as an agricultural product. There's just certain things, certain kinds of testing and stuff that has to happen when any new agricultural product that is going to enter the human use, human consumption supply, whether it's food or otherwise. Canada had no problem implementing its hemp industry in these regards. They've got the whole system set up, dialed in, and it's perfectly fine. So we should be able to do it here. On Charlie's point that hemp can't be grown in the same place as psychoactive cannabis, he is absolutely correct, absolutely right. The whole point of psychoactive cannabis is big flowers, females only, no seeds. Hemp is wild, let it grow where it grows in dense quantities, and it would immediately dilute the quality of psychoactive cannabis, so those need to be separated. Also, not a problem. California already had legislation that passed both of its houses for the southern conservative part of the state to be the only parts that would be growing hemp when federal cannabis prohibition comes online. The other aspect that Charlie, along the list that he was talking about, what we have to watch for when the drug war ends to make sure sneaky stuff doesn't happen that's not good for the country and not good for its people, is the driving under the influence category, or let's say, again, the stigma, teachers or pilots. And what that is about is THC is a molecule that can stay in your body for up to a month. And so you can't have roadside tests that have per se, as they call it in legal terms, a specified amount of THC in your body to indicate intoxication, because it affects everybody differently, lasts a long time. Besides, our real intoxication on the road problem, as everybody knows these days, is good old alcohol and relatively new prescription pill abuse, where people are zonked out on OxyContin or whatever. And that is not showing up in a breathalyzer either. So rather than worry about THC limits, what we need to ask law enforcement to do is come to a 21st century model of sobriety testing that is across the board and affects public safety on the road rather than what a specific test.
So some kind of test that would test your judgment or something like that?
Yeah, I would think it would be a very easy handheld device, you know. Are your pupils following a light? Can you, whatever it is, you know. And again, I'm not welcoming more intrusiveness of law enforcement into people's lives in general. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but it's a public safety issue. Patrick, right. Welcome to Talk of Alaska from Kenai. Oops, Patrick's gone because that was exactly Patrick's question that he was going to ask. You jumped the gun on him. Thanks, Patrick, for hanging up the phone so we can get to another caller from Homer. And Tom and Homer is gone, but Chelsea and Homer is still there. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chelsea. Oh, Dan Chelsea's gone. Wow. Let's try.
Maybe we're covering all the topics.
Well, it could be. Kenneth in Anchorage.
One topic. Oh,
Kenneth, go ahead.
Hello. Guys, it's a great show. I'm not one to really call shows and stuff like that, but you know, something that's really deep in my heart. I had a knee operation about 10 years ago, and they sent me home with one of those Oxycontin deals and some sleeping pills and something for constipation. So my night was like I would be in pain, and I would take the pain pill, and then before I'd go to sleep, I'd take the sleeping pill. And I went from 240 pounds to 285. I was a PE teacher here for most of my life, and I'm great shape. But like I said, I went from 240 to 285. And one night, I just I called the doctor guy up and said, "Hey, I took the pill. I took the other one. I can't sleep." And he kind of laughed. He said, "Ha ha, take another sleeping pill." And I got off the phone and said, "Wait a minute, this is crazy." I said, "That man doesn't care whether I live or die." I took a bag of pain pills. I threw them across the room, and I just got through it. But it was hard. I had a back operation about 4 years ago, and the guy gave me the same kind of prescription and stuff. And I went home. I thought about it. I started smoking when I was about 27 years old. So you know, but the thing is, I went to a friend of mine who never smoked a joint in his life. I said, "Hey, I need to borrow $200 from you." He gave me the $200. I took another $100 that I had. I bought me an ounce of weed. I used that for my pain and rehabilitative deal. I gained no weight, and I healed a whole lot faster. And I think where I'm at in life now, I'm 71 now. I find myself around my older brothers and sisters, and they're just copping out to these daggum pills. And I like what you're doing. And actually, it's a great show. I don't really talk too much, but thank you for listening to me.
Well, thank you, Kenneth, and that pretty well wraps up the show, so I appreciate you. You got a very interesting last word in there, Doug Vine.
I hear a lot of stories along those lines. For those who want to see this war on drugs end for the good of the country, if you're a preacher or religious person, speak the truth, as Charlie pointed out, and you have a signature ballot initiative going down that I just checked online. It has 15,000 of its 45,000 signatures. I think it has till December to get there. I heard support of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, we'll be talking it up. It's very odd. The last time we had one of these, the only people we could get to come on that would oppose legalizing were the P-test people. Imagine that, Doug.
Shock, shock, shock.
All right. Thanks a lot for being with us, Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.